For over 10 years, Mama Cares has been there for local musicians in their time of need, whether to help with medical expenses or other personal calamities. Madison Area Music Association invites you to Mama Cares 10th Anniversary Ball, Sunday, March 30th from 3 to 8 p.m. at the High Noon, featuring live performances by Sam Ness, Gin Chocolate and Bottle Rockets, and The Jimmies. Help your local musicians and enjoy some live music at the Mama Cares 10th Anniversary Ball, Sunday, March 30th from 3 to 8 p.m. at the High Noon Saloon. You're listening to WORT Madison.
You're listening to WORT 89.9 FM, Madison, Wisconsin.
Do you have an insatiable curiosity about the world? Do you find yourself provoking conversations with your friends and coworkers? Are you a strong listener? Then you should consider applying to become the next host of A Public Affair, WORT's daily hour-long call-in talk program. We're now accepting applications for this volunteer position. The next host will be the voice of Tuesday's show and join a stellar lineup of folks who engage listeners in conversations on social, cultural, and political issues of importance every day of the week. We're looking for someone who is curious and well-informed, comfortable speaking on air, someone who can think on their feet and has at least 5 hours a week to prepare and host the show. And of course, we'll need you to be here every Tuesday from 12 to 1 p.m. Apply by May 2nd. To find out more information or apply, go to wortfm.org/talkhost.
Welcome to Worldview, your weekly source for news and analysis from around the world, right here on community-supported radio, WORT 89.9 FM.
Good evening, and welcome to the Sunday, March 30th edition of Worldview. I'm Lee Rowe, and I'm your host. And Eid Mubarak to all those who celebrate. Later in our program, we have Dr. Anatoly Detweiler, an assistant professor of modern Chinese literature and cultural history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, in the studio here to talk about China with Amitabh Pal. Professor Detweiler has taught China-related courses in a number of departments, including history and political science at the UW-Madison and other universities, and has spent time in both China and Taiwan. He's also collaborated on several books on Chinese literature and culture and has a third book coming out later this year. So please stay tuned for that discussion, which will begin at about half past the hour. But first, we have the news.
College and university professors and administrators say that President Trump's hard lines on immigration, cuts to federal funding for research grants, and policing campus activism are worrying international students in the U.S. and those who once thought they would study here. Clay Harmon, executive director of AIRC, a membership organization focused on recruiting and enrolling international students, said, quote, "It has a chilling effect. Even if there's no direct consequence or direct limitation right now, all of this cumulatively produces an impression that the United States is not welcoming, it's not open, or that you may be in some kind of danger or jeopardy if you do come to the U.S., unquote. On a recent trip to India, the biggest sender of students to the U.S., the consensus among recruiting agencies was that far fewer of that country's students are interested in American colleges than in recent years. Some students are waiting to see what happens, and others are requesting deferred admissions. Still others are applying to schools in the United Kingdom, Germany, or elsewhere in Europe. Some U.S. schools are responding to students' apprehension with frequently updated webpages to keep current and prospective students informed. Others have warned students who are not U.S. citizens about their vulnerability to arrest or deportation.
An article from the International Center for Tax and Development, published last week, says that African countries that are facing some of the worst debt levels in over a decade should focus on tax contributions of their wealthy citizens. The center says that even though wealthy people have higher tax liabilities, they remain invisible to tax authorities, while citizens with formal labor contracts like school teachers and supermarket clerks have their taxes withheld by their employers. It offers an example of Uganda, where prior to 2015, only one of the top Ugandan government officials and 17 of the country's most successful lawyers paid personal income tax. It said that similarly, only 16% of all landlords identified in Freetown, the capital of Sierra Leone, during a registration drive in 2021, had registered for taxes. The center said an effective approach to increase wealthy citizens' tax contribution relies on identifying high earners and people who own property, simplifying tax compliance processes, and effectively enforcing existing taxes can lead to significant revenue gains. In Uganda, the government collected $5.5 million from high earners, and in Sierra Leone, the government tripled property tax revenue collection. The tax center said that revenue services need to be better resourced and need to focus on high net worth individuals for which criteria should be defined. Then an office to follow those individuals and their wealth acquisition should be established and steps for collecting that revenue set up. The tax center also said that requiring candidates running for public office to obtain tax clearance certificates can also be an important source of information and revenue and has been particularly successful in Uganda and Nigeria.
U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth visited the Philippines last week and met with President Ferdinand Marcos Jr. and Secretary of National Defense Gilberto Teodoro. After the meeting, Secretary Hegseth said, quote, "The United States has been fighting shoulder to shoulder with the Philippines since World War II. Our partnership not only continues today, but we are doubling down on that partnership, and our ironclad alliance has never been stronger," unquote. He went on to highlight an ongoing $500 million commitment by the United States to support the Philippines' military modernization. The two countries have also agreed that the United States will deploy additional advanced weapons to the Philippines, including the Nemesis anti-ship missile and unmanned surface vehicles. They will also conduct joint training of special operation forces this spring to improve how the nations cooperate in high-end operations. All of this is seen as a counter to China's claims of dominance in the South China Sea. Hegseth said, quote, "Our partnership demonstrates our commitment to peace and security in the Indo-Pacific. As our president talks about often and demonstrates, we will achieve peace through strength. We do not seek war, we seek peace, but for those who long for peace, must prepare for war," unquote.
While major changes in U.S. federal spending on employment and scientific research have been launched by the new administration, secondary effects are starting to emerge. Last week, a senior analyst at the Washington-based think tank Foundation for Defense of Democracies, Max Lesser, published his research on a secretive Chinese tech network that has been attempting to recruit recently laid off U.S. government workers through fake consulting and headhunting firms. Job ads have been posted on sites like LinkedIn and Craigslist. Lesser points out, quote, "What makes this activity significant is that the network seeks to exploit the financial vulnerabilities of former federal workers affected by recent mass layoffs," unquote. Reuters News Service, which reported the story, could not determine if the companies are linked to the Chinese government or whether any former federal workers were actually recruited. They quoted a White House spokesperson saying, quote, both active and former government employees must recognize the danger these governments pose and the importance of safeguarding government information, unquote. Chinese government has denied knowledge of the companies involved in the recruitment efforts.
The Supreme Court of Brazil has issued a ruling that former President Jair Bolsonaro, as well as seven of his close political allies, should face criminal prosecution for orchestrating a military coup. Bolsonaro served as president from 2019 until 2022, when he narrowly lost his bid for re-election. The former president and his allies allegedly attempted to subvert the democratic process by inciting riots, which would call for the military intervention and stall the inauguration of his successor. The allegations also outline plots to assassinate top political figures. Brazil's Attorney General, Paulo Gonet, described the investigation findings as having, quote, uncovered a terrifying operation to carry out the coup, which even included killing the president and vice president-elect, as well as that of a Supreme Court minister, unquote. Bolsonaro has dismissed the allegations as judicial persecution designed to end his political career and silence Brazil's right-wing party. In a written statement released after the Supreme Court ruling, Bolsonaro said, quote, the Brazilian people are being robbed of their right to choose their leader, and no country can call itself a democracy when its most popular candidate is barred from the ballot through judicial maneuvers, unquote. If found guilty, Bolsonaro could face up to 40 years in prison.
U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem visited El Salvador's Maximum Security Terrorism Confinement Center, known as CECOT, last Wednesday, where 300 migrants deported from the U.S. are currently being held. Critics of the Trump administration's deportation policies denounced the visit as aiming to spread fear among migrants and promote inhumane and illegal treatment of deported migrants. In a video message recorded in the facility, Noem said, quote, first of all, do not come to our country illegally. You will be removed and you will be prosecuted. But know that this facility is one of the tools in our toolkit that we will use if you commit crimes against the American people, unquote. The migrants currently held in CECOT are accused of being dangerous gang members, although many assert that there is no evidence to support those accusations. Many of the men currently held in CECOT have not been convicted or in some cases even charged with any crimes. The Venezuelan government has hired lawyers to represent the 238 Venezuelan migrants currently held at the facility. They have since filed a habeas corpus petition, a move that compels El Salvador to prove each of the detentions is lawful or face legal prosecution.
Iranian President Masoud Pezeshkian said today that his country had rejected direct negotiations with the United States in response to a letter from U.S. President Donald Trump regarding Iran's nuclear program. Pezeshkian confirmed during an Iranian cabinet meeting that his country's response to the U.S. president's letter was delivered by the Sultanate of Oman in the Arabian Peninsula. Pezeshkian said, quote, despite the rejection of the idea of direct negotiations between the two parties in this response, it was emphasized that the path of indirect negotiation remains open, adding, we never refused to negotiate, but rather the failure of the U.S. to fulfill promises has caused the problems, which requires correcting the course and rebuilding trust, unquote. The negotiations have failed for years since 2018 when President Trump unilaterally withdrew the United States from the 2015 nuclear agreement, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA, signed between Iran and six world powers, China, France, Germany, Russia, the UK, and the US. The European Union was also a signatory to the agreement, which relieved billions of dollars of Iranian sanctions in exchange for accepting unprecedented restrictions and inspections of Iran's nuclear program.
Thousands of participants in Moroccan cities, including Tangier, Meknes, Fez, Casablanca, Barshid, Oujda, and Berkane, held solidarity demonstrations last night in support of Palestinian steadfastness and in an effort to persuade their government to pressure Israel to stop the genocide in Gaza and allow aid into the blockaded Gaza Strip. The first phase of a ceasefire and prisoner exchange agreement between Hamas and Israel, which went into effect January 19th, ended at the beginning of March. Despite Hamas's commitment to all terms of the agreement, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu refused to proceed with the second phase of the agreement. Responding to pressure from Zionist extremists in his government, Netanyahu instead resumed the aggression against Gaza and the West Bank, where the Israeli occupation forces continue to attack towns and cities in occupied Palestine, with an ongoing campaign of raids, arrests, assassinations, and restrictions on movement of people, food, shelter, and medical supplies and water. And those are our headlines for today. Now here's Neil with our first longer story.
The world's newest country, South Sudan, which became independent from Sudan in 2011, is in the news again for its leaders' inability to reconcile and collaborate for the benefit of its citizens. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres told reporters on Friday, quote, "Let's not mince words. What we're seeing is darkly reminiscent of the 2013 and 2016 civil wars, which killed 400,000 people," unquote. Guterres listed a security emergency, political upheaval, a humanitarian nightmare, a displacement and funding crisis, and an economic meltdown in addition to ethnic and political targeting by security forces and the spread of misinformation on social media as problems currently affecting South Sudan and threatening the peace. President Salva Kiir put First Vice President Riek Machar under house arrest in the capital, Juba, on Wednesday, in effect voiding a 2018 peace deal that ended a five-year civil war. Kenyan President William Ruto, who chairs the East African Committee Bloc, IGAD, said he had spoken to Kiir about Machar's detention, and former Kenyan Prime Minister Odinga said he met with Kiir on Friday and was encouraged by the possibility of the conflict being resolved. The U.S. State Department Bureau of African Affairs wrote on X, quote, "We urge President Kiir to reverse this action and prevent further escalation of the situation," unquote. And the African Union Commission's chair, Mahmoud Ali Yusuf, said he would deploy a team to Juba as, quote, "part of the efforts to de-escalate the situation," unquote. Guterres said that the UN mission in South Sudan, or UNMISS, is, quote, "working around the clock to ease tensions, engaging all parties, and boosting protections of civilians," unquote. UNMISS put out a plea to the Sudanese politicians on Wednesday night, saying that it, quote, "urges the parties to immediately cease hostilities and engage in constructive dialogue that puts the best interest of their people at the forefront of this pivotal moment for the world's newest nation," unquote. Meanwhile, there are rumors and reports that the Sudanese army and the Sudanese militia, the Rapid Support Forces, have been in touch with the South Sudanese fighters to join in their battle for power in Sudan.
The U.S. government this week announced that it would provide $73 million to fund the World Food Program and the ongoing aid it is providing to Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh. At the same time, questions are being raised about what to do in a situation that has dragged on for years with no resolution in sight. The Rohingya people are a primarily Muslim minority from Myanmar, where they have a history of discrimination, persecution, and armed conflict. They have effectively been denied citizenship since 1982, making them one of the most recent stateless people in the world. In 2017, the Rohingya population in Myanmar was estimated to be at around 1.4 million. It was then that the Myanmar military increased the level of ethnic cleansing, which drove around half of that population to neighboring countries, especially Bangladesh. Currently, Bangladesh hosts around 1 million Rohingya in refugee status. Rohingya conditions in Bangladesh are poor. They are still denied legal status and have limited access to employment, education, and health care. While the humanitarian crisis continues, more attention has focused on how refugees become trapped in a cycle of dependency on international aid and can become subject to exploitation. The United States has been the largest provider of aid to the Rohingya refugees, contributing nearly $2.4 billion since 2017, according to the State Department. Bangladesh initially received international praise for its humanitarian response to the Rohingya, but it has emerged that the refugees are kept isolated in rudimentary camps and without rights. The Bangladesh government shuts down Rohingya businesses and keeps the refugees dependent on aid and subject to being used as cheap labor in informal markets. This also creates conflict between the refugees and local working class populations. The Bangladesh government has used the refugee crisis to gain international support, and the global aid industry can benefit more from a crisis than the refugees themselves, all while avoiding the real issue of granting refugees like the Rohingya meaningful rights or means of self-sufficiency. Tammy Bruce, the State Department spokesperson who announced the renewed funding, said, quote, "This food and nutrition support through the World Food Program will provide critically needed food and nutrition assistance for more than 1 million people. It is important that our international partners engage with sharing the burden with life-saving assistance such as this," unquote.
South Korea, over the last 2 weeks, has seen the third largest series of wildfires in the country's history, with nearly 90,000 acres burned. At least 27 people have died, and the fires have destroyed over 3,000 structures, including homes, factories, and an ancient Buddhist temple. 37,000 people have been forced to evacuate. In comparison, the January wildfires in Southern California destroyed more than 18,000 homes and structures and burned more than 57,000 acres. The Korea Forest Service raised its wildfire warning to the highest level nationwide as ongoing dry conditions and strong winds fueled the fire's spread. South Korean authorities deployed over 6,000 personnel, including firefighters and soldiers, to fight the fires and used 242 helicopters for water drops. The BBC quoted Lee Byung-do from the National Institute of Forest Science in Seoul as saying, quote, "Pine trees contain resin, which acts like oil, intensifying fires when ignited. This resin causes wildfires to burn faster, stronger, and longer. Because of forests in South Korea contain large numbers of pine trees, the areas are particularly vulnerable when fires break out," unquote. Early investigations point to human causes for the fires. A 56-year-old man was blamed for mistakenly starting one of the worst fires while tending to his grandparents' gravesites. The man was trying to clear overgrown tree branches by burning them with a cigarette lighter. Today, fires are reported as mostly contained, but efforts at keeping the fire from reigniting continue.
A Kenyan officer is missing after a violent gang attack in Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince, on Tuesday. Since June of 2024, Kenya has sent over 800 security personnel to Haiti to assist in the ongoing conflict with violent gangs that have taken over much of the city. Multiple Kenyan officers were dispatched on Tuesday to rescue a group of Haitian police officers who were reportedly stuck in a ditch suspected to have been deliberately dug by the gangs. During the rescue mission, the Kenyan force was attacked, with local media outlets reporting that one Kenyan officer was killed. According to the UN, gang violence in Haiti has left more than 1 million people displaced and homeless in recent years, leaving many to live in crowded makeshift shelters that lack potable water and proper sanitation. The Haitian government, backed by the UN and international aid groups, has continued to lose ground to the gangs in recent weeks. The mission has further been weakened after the U.S. freeze of foreign aid. It is now estimated that gangs control over 85% of Port-au-Prince, including nearly all roads providing access to the parts of the capital still under the control of Haiti's transitional government. According to Halo Solutions firm, a security company in the capital, quote, as armed groups expand their control, government institutions have retreated, leaving critical infrastructure unprotected, unquote. This includes government facilities, port facilities, and schools, many of which have been forced to evacuate or relocate over the course of the last week. Haiti's temporary government, which is required to hold elections this year, has indicated that elections may not be possible as the necessary preparations are not in place.
A report released by Human Rights Watch on Wednesday determined that the actions of rebel groups in Colombia's northern region of Catatumbo include, quote, grave abuses, unquote, of human rights. The National Liberation Army, or ELN, launched a campaign in January to gain control of the Catatumbo region along the border with Venezuela. The ongoing conflict has left more than 56,000 people displaced from their homes and 122,000 now requiring urgent assistance. Many of those now living in refugee camps are experiencing shortages of food and potable water and have no access to medicine or proper sanitation. The 12-page report issued by Human Rights Watch accuses the ELN of executing civilians and forcibly recruiting young boys to fight in the conflict. President Gustavo Petro of Colombia is facing criticism as his policy of dialoguing with armed groups in the region has been unsuccessful in creating a lasting ceasefire. Juan Papier, the Human Rights Watch Deputy Director for the Americas, said, quote, it seems that the ELN is trying to control the border with Venezuela, partly due to the drug trade, and for that they've long benefited from the complicity of Venezuelan security forces, unquote. The renewed conflict between rebel groups has sparked some of the fiercest violence the country has seen since 2016 peace deal with another rebel group known as FARC-EMC resulted in over 13,000 fighters laying down their weapons. Beatriz Carvajal, a 50-year-old teacher from the region, said, quote, it's very intense. Everyone is in a state of panic because we are all wondering where they are going to bomb next. I am in a group with other teachers, and none of us can remember anything like this since the 1990s, when Pablo Escobar was blowing up whatever he wanted, unquote.
Demonstrations and rallies in support of Palestinians and in condemnation of the genocide committed against them by the Israeli occupation forces were reported around the world over the weekend. European cities are holding solidarity marches commemorating Land Day, annually observed by Palestinians on March 30th to commemorate the 1976 general strike and clashes between Palestinian and Israeli residents in the 1948 occupied territories and the Israeli military and police forces. In Dortmund, Bonn, and Frankfurt, Palestinian and Arab institutions, associations, and pro-Palestinian groups organized demonstrations and sit-ins. In Berlin, movements and associations led by the Jewish Voice Movement, Eye on Palestine, Palestine Resists, and other pro-Palestine organizations participated in protests to denounce the ongoing genocide in Gaza. But in many cases, German authorities intervened to stop them. In Paris, the Euro-Palestine Association organized a demonstration under the slogan, Palestine cannot be taken or sold. Protesters carried symbolic coffins of children, a reference to the massacres committed by the occupation in the Gaza Strip. In the UK, demonstrators demanded that the British government halt arms exports to Israel and end its complicity in potential war crimes. In Madrid, thousands of Spaniards gathered, some with banners saying, Netanyahu, the criminal, freedom for Palestine, and peace. A statement by the Stop the War movement, which organizes the demonstrations and includes approximately 100 civil society organizations in Spain, emphasized that they condemn the Israeli regime's violation of the ceasefire in Gaza its crimes against innocent civilians, and the escalation of genocide.
Yemen's Houthi group announced today that it had successfully targeted Ben Gurion Airport in central Israel with a ballistic missile. Yehia Sari, the group's military spokesman, said in a televised statement that the operation was carried out, quote, in support of the oppressed Palestinian people and in support of their dear struggling resistance, unquote. Sari considered the bombing of the Israeli airport to confirm, quote, the failure of the American aggression to prevent Yemen from continuing its support operations for the Palestinian people, unquote. He said, quote, the dozens of daily raids will not deter our forces from fulfilling their religious, moral, and humanitarian duties, and they will continue their operations against the Israeli enemy until the aggression on Gaza stops and the siege is lifted, unquote. Earlier today, the Israeli military announced that it had intercepted a missile fired from Yemen before it entered Israeli airspace after sirens sounded in the Jerusalem and Greater Tel Aviv area. Since November 2023, the Houthis have said that in solidarity with Gaza, in the face of Israeli genocide, they began targeting Israeli-owned or linked cargo ships in the Red Sea or anywhere else they could reach with missiles and drones. U.S. President Donald Trump announced that he had ordered his military to launch a major attack, quote, against the Houthi group and later threatened to, quote, completely destroy the Houthis, unquote. The Houthi-affiliated Al-Misara TV reported yesterday that an American aggression targeted Sada Governorate in northern Yemen with seven airstrikes. Continued American airstrikes for days against areas Washington says are controlled by the Houthis have killed and wounded dozens, many of them civilians, as well as caused significant material damage to public and private property.
And that's a wrap of the news from around the world for Sunday, March 30th, 2025. I'm Lee Rowe.
I'm Neil Adams.
Sources we used to prepare today's stories were Agence France-Presse, Al Jazeera, Anadolu, the Associated Press, the BBC, Deutsche Welle, France 24, The Guardian, Independent, IRNA, The Miami Herald, The Middle East Monitor, The World, Himal South Asia, Human Rights Watch, Reuters, the UN Mission to South Sudan, UN News, the U.S. Department of State, and X. And now we're going to take a quick break while our guest comes into the studio, and then we'll be right back.
Hello, my name is Amitabh Pal. I'm the Communications Director for the Freedom From Religion Foundation, and I teach courses at Edgewood College. And it's such a privilege and pleasure for me to have somebody In the studio to discuss China, Professor Anatoly Detweiler and I have played squash together at the squash club here in town. And when I was starting to teach international relations courses at Edgewood, I thought of him as a China expert who could come in and explain China to my class. And it's such a wonderful primer that I thought that we'd get him into the studio to discuss the primer to our WART audience. So Professor Detweiler is an assistant professor of modern Chinese literature and cultural history at UW-Madison, where he regularly offers China-related courses. He earned his PhD in Chinese and comparative literature from Columbia in 2015. He has traveled many times to mainland China and Taiwan for study, research, and collaboration. He is the co-editor of two books published with Columbia University Press in 2021, of which I am a prouder owner of one of them, Information, a Reader. And his third book titled Seeing Through Abstraction, Literary Encounters with Information in Modern China is forthcoming with Columbia University Press later this year. So welcome, Professor Detweiler.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Professor Detweiler, I mean, as I said, you offer this great primer and intro on how to understand China and China-related issues to my class. Let's begin with something that's on everybody's mind, the U.S.-China relationship. We discuss in my class the Thucydides trap, Thucydides' writing on the Peloponnesian War and how Athens and Sparta were destined to be in conflict with each other as an established power and a rising power. We've had Pete Hegseth go very recently to Japan and talk about the shared warrior ethos and how that'll help U.S. and Japan confront the quote-unquote communist China aggression. Can you please tell our audience where in recent times your assessment of where the U.S.-China relationship has been and where it's headed?
Thanks. That's really a great question and a very, very urgent one, right? Because over the last 15 years, we've seen in America really a kind of decline in interest in China, and also this emerging idea that China will abandon political liberalization and economic liberalization and become sort of more communist in this old school sense. And so U.S.-China relations have really followed that. We're seeing more and more now kind of a hawkish posturing towards China, and even this talk of, are we now in a kind of new Cold War with China and the United States looking for regional allies, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, of course, and so on. So I think overall in the United States, in terms of our government, we've now, through the last couple of presidencies, seen this posture of competition. And I would note that the Biden presidency was not substantially different from Trump 1. And Trump 2, of course, is a continuation of what we've been seeing. And Republicans and Democrats in Congress agree on so little. One thing that they do really agree on is the need to kind of contain China, right? This, of course, is running up against another idea that's very popular in the Trump administration, which is kind of U.S. withdrawal from the world stage. That doesn't really jive well with, containment per se. But overall, the United States is politically, economically, technologically competing with China, right? And in the field of technology, for example, this is one that I think is on the news all the time. We see that America is really trying to protect American industries on the one hand, and then also trying to kneecap Chinese firms on the other. So I'm thinking here in particular of sanctions and other threats to Chinese companies like WeChat, to Huawei, the telecom giant, and of course TikTok, this really popular social media platform that's both operating in the United States and then also in China today. And it's all leading towards a kind of economic decoupling between American industry and Chinese industry. China is de-Americanizing its supply chains and vice versa. And American brands are really very fast declining in China. There's actually some active boycotts going on. We've been, involved in partial trade wars since 2018. And so overall, then, we are very much possibly in a new Cold War, depending on just kind of how we call this. Yeah.
And the other scenario in which China is mentioned and almost hyphenated is with Russia, you know, China-Russia. And that's the other rivalry, you know, U.S.-Russia, especially vis-a-vis Ukraine. How would you situate China in that dynamic?
That's also just a very interesting and also complicated situation. Putin and the Chinese president, Xi Jinping, they're really in a bear hug. It's kind of a no-limits cooperation that they have. China has very much stepped in to become a major trading partner with Russia as Russia's faced sanctions from the Western world following its invasion of Ukraine. I think even more so, China is very interested in what's happening in Ukraine and what the West's response is, because the invasion of Ukraine, of course, is a violation of international law. But at the same time, it's in some ways a kind of historical mirror for what China wants to do in Taiwan, right? Because you have in Russia's invasion of Ukraine, Russia is making kind of claims to Ukrainian territory based on its imperial history. And this is really a very strong parallel to the case of Taiwan. Taiwan is, of course, claimed by China as to fall under Chinese sovereignty, but then Taiwan sees itself as an independent nation state. So I think China has a direct vested interest in how things unfold in Ukraine, because it would possibly like to follow that model in the case of Taiwan.
And one thing that caught my attention that you told my students is the reversal in polls of Taiwanese attitudes toward mainland China. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, that's also something that is unfolding before our very eyes. We're talking here about domestic opinion within Taiwan about the possibility of eventually reunifying with mainland China. And there are polls that have been conducted annually about what people in Taiwan want. And up until about 2019, approximately two-thirds of Taiwanese said that they supported eventual reunification with mainland China. And that's because many Taiwanese people have family ties in China. They're culturally, they see themselves as being Chinese. And I think there would be a lot of economic opportunities for a formal reunification. In 2019, things really changed. This was due to things that were happening in Hong Kong. Hong Kong, of course, was quote unquote handed back to mainland China in 1997. And when that happened, the accommodation was that there would be a one state, two systems arrangement with Hong Kong. So Hong Kong would be, of course, under Chinese sovereignty, but then it would be allowed to maintain some of its political liberal structure without much interference from Beijing. That was supposed to go on for 50 years. And then the Chinese state decided to expedite the integration process. And this ended up provoking popular resistance in Hong Kong. It even got so far as to have street protests and some really bad optics. I mean, there was a kind of siege by the state on these student protesters at Hong Kong Polytechnic University in 2019 and so on. And this was observed very carefully by Taiwan, right? Because it's a kind of harbinger of what reunification might look like and whether China, the state, would hold its word about whatever accommodations were arrived at by both sides. And as this unfolded, the popular sentiment in Taiwan really turned away from eventual reunification. So that previously it was two-thirds pro eventual reunification and one-third against that. Now it's flipped, and in Taiwan it is two-thirds of the people are against reunification while one-third are still pro unification.
And they are gearing up, are they, for a possible kind of Chinese, even more aggressive posture?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, China has very frequent military exercises around Taiwan. The Taiwanese are prepared for the reality of a possible invasion. Whether or not there would be an invasion or some kind of blockade or other kind of interference, direct interference, is, of course, up to interpretation at this point, right? But we're living in a very precarious time for Taiwan, because the United States as an ally is becoming increasingly difficult to depend on, yeah. Right? We've sort of gone back on many of our alliances, and the Taiwanese are ready now, I think, to start investing more in their own self-defense.
So China, in order to counter the United States, is projecting power in a number of ways. One is through the what's been termed the One Belt, One Road initiative, and also the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, through BRICS. How have these panned out in reality? And there has been some pushback against them, hasn't there?
Yes. So the One Belt, One Road initiative, or the Yidai Yilu in Chinese, was announced in 2013, just 1 year after Xi Jinping assumed leadership in China. So it's very much tied in with his leadership. And it's really administered through the Asian Infrastructure Bank. And it is involved in building up infrastructure across the world, primarily in the global south, so Central Asia, Southeast Asia, South and Central America, but it extends well beyond that into places like Israel, Italy, and also Russia. And essentially, it's a way for China to build its international profile economically, diplomatically, and potentially militarily. So on the economic side, China can emerge as a kind of leader within the global south, and it can open up opportunities for trade with emerging markets. On the diplomatic side, China can leverage the debt that countries go into to pay for this infrastructure and turn that into political support. So one of the ways that we see that unfolding in a very real way is in the case of the PRC's human rights abuses in Xinjiang, right? And of course, we're talking about Uyghurs here. They're Muslim people. And then Muslim majority countries, which participate in the One Belt, One Road initiative, have been very slow to speak out about these human rights abuses. And so you can sort of see there's a direct payoff for China on the international stage, infrastructural investment, you know, then you have less kind of protest or sort of religious solidarity. And then on the military side of things, there is a lot of fear mongering, I think, in the United States about China building up its military capacity abroad and, you know, sometimes building docks or highways could possibly lead to more capacity to project military might. China has not been so explicit and direct in saying that we're putting down these as military bases, but it's certainly the possibility would be there. Now, this has been around for over a decade, and the popularity of the Yidai Yilu, or One Belt, One Road initiative, has declined both within China and abroad. Abroad, it's starting to be seen with some skepticism because of this anxiety of your country falling into a debt trap and then owing something. And then at home, with the shrinking of the GDP and the slowing of the growth rate of the GDP, there's increasing unpopularity of sending resources abroad to build things elsewhere, right? It's keep the resources at home where it could be better used for the people directly.
Speaking of home and economics in China, Professor Detweiler, one other fascinating thing for me, and you reinforced that for my class, is how hard it is to term and pin down the Chinese economic system, because it's such a fascinating hybrid of socialism and capitalism. And there's a new book that you recommend, which is on my reading list, that actually really tries to bring that point home. Can you talk about that with our for our listeners?
Yeah, sure. I mean, China, of course, is led by the Chinese Communist Party, but it would be too simplistic to think of China as being socialist in any direct, in sort of genuine way. China is neither socialist nor capitalist, purely speaking. Some people, like the scholar Frank Pieke, calls it a case of neo-socialism, where you have this mixture of market liberalization, and it's really aimed at strengthening state capacity and bolstering the Leninist Party within China. Of course, the Leninist Party here meaning you have a one-party government, right? In any case, Xi Jinping and the Communist Party do believe in socialism, and they talk about this frequently, but it's of a very flexible type, and it oftentimes manifests in the Communist Party investing in private firms for the sake of national interests. So we could see this, for example, in the AI race and the development of new things like DeepSeek, right? It's been in the news recently. Yeah. The book recommendation on this is a recent monograph titled The New China Playbook, Beyond Socialism and Capitalism, by a scholar of political science and economics named Keyu Jin. That's K-E-Y-U, and then the last name is J-I-N. And she gives a very good breakdown of how the government in China works and kind of how complicated this mix of socialism and capitalism really is.
So to close the interview, Professor Detweiler, you have three invaluable recommendations for people to keep in mind while assessing China. Can you please go over these?
Yes, of course. I mean, I'm someone who's really very much invested in having better relations between our countries. I think at the end of the day, we need to remember that civilizations don't clash, empires do, right? And we need to, in some ways, reject being totally represented by our government, right? I mean, whether or not you agree with Trump and his politics or Biden or whomever it is, right? You wouldn't necessarily want to be stereotyped or represented by the flag in any direct way. So we're living in a moment where it's important to remember the same is true of the Chinese, and China is immensely complicated. So I think there's a couple of different things that we should do as responsible global citizens, right? One is we should take a China-centric understanding to what China is doing abroad, right? So that is to say that in terms of China's foreign policy, it's driven by domestic concerns, right? China's not a hollow entity. And at home, there's a lot of economic anxiety about a slowing economy. There's a looming demographic crisis with an aging population. There's environmental degradation, there's censorship, there's lots of different problems that will then manifest in terms of foreign policy. But overall, it's crucial to remember that China is not monolithic, right? And that there's a lot of different opinions and a lot of different groups under the surface that we need to pay attention to.
And they can't disregard that even in an authoritarian system, you're saying?
Yes, that's also true. I mean, this would be the second point I think I would emphasize here, which is look to the Chinese Communist Party to understand what's going on.
Yeah.
The Communist Party, its primary drive and goal is to maintain its power within China, but it's also a very adaptable organ, right? It sets fairly clear goals and it publishes these goals. And so we know kind of what they're trying to do and how they're going to achieve these goals. And overall, it's quite good at identifying its failures and addressing them directly. Oftentimes in American media and including social media, we see stories about how the Chinese Communist Party is sort of on the brink of collapse. This happened in the aftermath of COVID. These are kind of fantasies, new Cold War fantasies, we could call them. We should understand that historically, the Chinese Communist Party has been actually very flexible and adaptable. So understand what the Chinese Communist Party wants and you can really understand what China is up to, both at home and abroad. And finally, I think it's important to look for opportunities to expand U.S.-China cooperation. And this, of course, is encountering a lot of headwinds these days, right? Because we're seeing a slowdown in economic growth. There's the global rise of nationalist right-wing movements. There's this talk of kind of zero-sum conflict between nation states over resources. I'm thinking here of Greenland, for example. And Trump's brand of economic protectionism is really symptomatic of this decline of neoliberalism. So where does this lead us, right? At the same time, I think at the state level, there's lots of potential for bilateral cooperation between the United States and China on issues like counter-narcotics, public health, climate change, AI regulation, and nuclear arms control. So we could put pressure on our government to really step up and work with China, which I think the Chinese are actually very eager to work with us on these issues. And at the individual level, of course, we should promote social cultural exchanges. This is key to combating things like disinformation and cultural misunderstanding. So our states are oftentimes very slow to change, but they are capable of change. And this kind of change will start at the level of the individual. I guess the last thing I would say here is just with a recommendation for what I think is probably the best way we can build and maintain an in-depth study of China, and that is through signing up for a newsletter online. It's called Sinocism, and it's operated by a guy in Washington, D.C. named Bill Bishop, who reads tons and tons of Chinese media every day and then digests what are the most important 7 or 8 things happening and then sends out this regular newsletter. It's read by half of Washington, D.C. already. A lot of Sinologists or so-called China hands read this regularly, and it's something that if you just kind of look at on a regular basis, once or twice a month, you'll have really a far more in-depth understanding than the average citizen.
As the absolute last question, Professor Detweiler, since you are at the University of Wisconsin, all the tumult in higher education, you're talking about a campus cooperation between the United States and China. Surely this also must be, at the very least, up in the air.
Yes, absolutely. So, of course, the federal government is cutting funding for language study and cultural exchanges. At the same time, we see that Chinese counterparts, that is universities in China, are very eager to continue having exchanges with us. So it's a very dynamic situation, and one which I hope that eventually we can reverse just in terms of raising interest in China amongst American students.
Let's end on that optimistic, hopeful note. Thank you so much, Professor Detweiler, for taking the time and trouble to educate our listeners on China and how to understand China better. This
Thank
is Amitabh Pal, Communications Director of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, and here with me in the studio was Professor Anatoly Detweiler.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks so much for coming in. We really appreciate it. And I think, you know, we probably, if you would be willing, would like to talk to you again, because there are so many things and things come up really in the news about China. So we really appreciate to have somebody who knows what he's talking about come in and interpret it, or help us interpret it for our listeners.
It would be my pleasure.
Okay, well, thanks so much. And thanks also to our Worldview Collective members, Neil Adams, Sabia Tie, Chuck Benish, Andrew Karn, Gil Halstead, and Amitabh Pal, for bringing international news to WORT listeners. And thanks to WORT News and Public Affairs Director, Shali Pittman. And we especially thank you for listening. Please join us next week for a new edition of Worldview here on your community-supported radio, WORT 89.9 FM Madison and WORTFM.org, or on the app, which is available everywhere. And now, stay tuned for Salamat. Thank you.
View is written and produced by a collective of volunteers. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can also contact us here at this station if you're interested in joining our collective to bring world issues to the airwaves. Worldview can be heard every Sunday from 5 to 6 p.m. on WORT 89.9 FM.
Hi, I'm Randy, a longtime WORT listener and an Evergreen donor. This year, I will be donating to WORT through my IRA. To lessen my tax impact, I can make a donation to WORT, and this might even lower my Medicare premiums and put me in a lower tax bracket. If you are 70 and a half or older, you can do this too. Why did I decide to include WORT for part of my RMD distributions? Well, it's easy. It's the music. WORT has opened my ears to music I don't hear anywhere else. Donating to WORT is my way of saying thanks to this local treasure. To learn more about RMD donations, visit the donation page on WORTFM.org or email Susan at WORTFM.org. Happy 50th, WORT.
السلام عليكم 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 السلام عليكم